very much for your time and making time to walk through our processes today. We're going to jump right into it. It's good to see everybody. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, Doctor.
I will, not that this has anything to do with anything we're talking about, but I'm pretty happy about it. Hit 52 on Wednesday.
Happy birthday to you.
Thank you.
I'm pretty happy about that. So, Shannon, we'll put it in your hands.
And we're all not telling our ages, by the way.
No, that's not.
Oh, no one else asked to share. I feel very happy about mine.
That was the icebreaker question?
Very happy. And you are.
I am 29 again.
29 for the 30-second celebration.
You're a youngster. You're a youngster.
There we go.
From my vantage point.
I like that. Thank you. I'll accept it.
Jennifer.
With my 3 grown children and 5 grandchildren.
Wow. I'm still older than you.
Do you want me to introduce
her? Yeah, absolutely. Put in your hands and you can help us.
Do we want to do introductions or do we all know each other here at the table?
We know each other.
So thank you everybody for agreeing to do a special emergency meeting with us for the Bond Oversight Committee at the last minute. We realized as we are proceeding from the SAG framework to the actual implementation that we have a few key things that are starting, and we wanted to walk through and talk with you about those today. We've kind of tried to structure the meeting in a way that gives you a little context in the order of how we're going to speak about issues. So the request for interest is actually going to be Javier Mena, who'll be talking about that agenda item, which is the planned request for interest we have for property that we are hoping to release on Monday, the 23rd. Second, we'll be talking with you about, this is a new document that I believe you were emailed yesterday, which is our proposed internal process for how we're going to analyze those proposals once we receive them, and also just who's going to be at the table, and we'll have a discussion about that. And then finally, we're bringing to your attention possibly the first new development location for the bond, which is the 30th and Powell site, which the Bureau recently has acquired. We think this is going to be a good example for you to see how we're planning on applying the SAG framework to decisions for, they'll be slightly different for acquisition than they will be for new development, but we also wanted to bring this to your attention in advance because we are looking to bring one of our existing properties to use for the bond. So that's kind of how we've structured today. And with that, does anybody have any questions before we go right into the items?
Let's have a comment around it.
Okay.
As it relates to the RFI, the goal, thank you, Shannon, excellent. The goal is to thoroughly process. So whatever questions, whatever needs to be clarified, that's kind of our approach. We really want to be clear around this element. So.
Have a quick question. Can you remind me or us, I think we have meetings starting quarterly in January, and today is an emergency to discuss sort of pertinent issues. Do we have any other meetings before January? Are they only going to be in the case that we have other?
We have a potential hold on your calendar. I believe it's actually November 27th. I believe we had scoped out a potential time, and we thought actually that we would be using that time, but we realized with what we have going on and that we wanted to have an opportunity to talk with you about the RFI, we wanted an opportunity to talk with you about process, and so we did ask for this meeting. I don't anticipate another at this point, because I think as you'll hear when we're talking about process, we're hoping that there's a streamlined as we're buying buildings. I mean, we would be bringing, like we are with 30th and Powell, any new development opportunity when it involves new construction to share with you what the timeline and what the plans are. I would love to say we'd have something before January.
Yes.
But
it'll be November 27th from 9 to 12. There's a hold on this room. It's not on your calendar, so it's not finalized. So
we have that as a hold, but we don't know yet what the agenda would be. So.
And maybe that's the reason I ask at this point in the conversation, because I know we have a lot to push through, and maybe that's an opportunity for parking, lotting, park, whatever that's called, put off till the next meeting, but not until January. Because I know we've asked also for a debrief on the Ellington.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so you have. And we are getting ready to do that debrief. Quite frankly, we don't have the information we need to present to you in a full and comprehensive manner. But I believe by November 27th, I'm looking at that we'll have some more of the demographic data, and we'll have our tenancy plan in place.
We've only been doing tenant recertifications on lease renewals, so we're not asking for people to divulge their income until their leases come up. So that information, while you might think it was readily available when purchasing the property, was not. And we gave people the assurance of they would all get automatic one-year extensions, and as we then do those extensions, we're gathering that information. I'm not even sure it'll be done by the end of November, though.
Right. I think we have a good idea, but as Shannon mentioned, to do a comprehensive deep dive into the Ellington and talk about the who's there, what are their incomes, demographics, I think it's going to take a little more time.
But I do think we can share with you the memorandums of understanding and the tenancy that we're putting in place right now. There are vacancies coming online at the Ellington, and I'm looking down at the end of the table mostly to Jennifer, who's been doing the lion's share of the work, applying the policies of the SAG framework to our tenancy plan and how we're doing outreach to ensure that we're tenanting up in accordance. So we'll be able to present you at least at that meeting with how we're lining up the current tenancy and whatever information that we're able to share about. We'll know about anyone we've brought in. We may not know everything about those who are existing within the building yet. But that is a good reminder. And so we'll put that as an agenda item for the 27th meeting. Thank you, Jess.
Okay. Perfect. All right, Javi.
So going into the RFI, my understanding is that all of you received a copy, so definitely we'd love to hear your comments. And this follows the same type of format that we've had to I think a much more flexible scale than our typical NOFAs or our RFPs. But obviously it really reasserts the commitment to what the SAC framework has explained in the document itself in terms of the 1,300 units, the PSH units being 300 of them. So what this request is, we know and we have heard throughout the year from different developers, from property owners, that they're interested in bringing deals to the Bureau. And so this opens up the window for anybody to be able to say, okay, submit your proposals. We also understand that this may not be enough and that we have to do our own due diligence, and we will continue to do that. But what this does, at least, is opens up that window. And it says, if you have a property that you think meets that framework that we've listed here, or if you have an existing working apartment complex that you feel meets this criteria, we definitely are interested in seeing. It's different from what we had in our proposals, typically where it has an end time by which you have to submit your proposals. It's an open-ended window. So and we will go later into how we see this selection process moving forward. It does have some cost containment components into the proposals, and this follows what we had in the previous notifications in terms of how much per unit in cost we're looking at. And typically, for example, I wrote down the numbers in studios, it's $197,000 a unit. One bedroom is $256,000, two bedroom is $354,000. And so on. So that's, if you like the numbers, I can definitely send them to you. But that's the essence of the NOFA, of this RFI. We have an idea that we will get some proposals. It'll be yet to be seen whether those proposals are sufficient enough that we take it through the process that we'll be talking about later.
Okay.
So I think one thing that's come up in conversations about this pending NOFA is developers who would like to participate with the bond funds, but develop them first under the understanding that I'll build it, you guys will buy it from me at a certain point in time. Has staff been hearing the same kind of feedback?
Most definitely.
This says you've got to be able to do it within 120 days, so.
So that's the turnkey concept that you're talking about,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so we are having those conversations, and our hope or our goal is to have some type of turnkey concept to be shared later. We're still working through internal processes within the city as to what that looks like and with the bond council.
So turnkey would have to be, we have a draft of a contract, what that would look like to be able to say, you know, here are the parameters we'll be looking at, we'll buy it from you. We've distributed that out both to Housing Oregon Policy Council,
right,
and a couple of developers that have asked for it. We'd like to get feedback generally on that agreement. But what will the process for turnkey under the public improvement code, public contracting code, would require us to establish an alternative contracting method pilot program. And so we have to additionally meet a number of findings under state law, specifically as to making sure that the contracting method would still, would not stifle competition and would actually result, we believe could result in decreased cost. So we're working on making those, doing that portion of the work, and then also we want to make sure that we've kind of got the agreement buttoned up. We'd be bringing that for council approval. And as the director has currently said, we'd be looking at both a time and dollar duration with a certain amount of the funds from, and we believe that that would probably supplement our work on the new development side of the bond program. So I would imagine that probably actually about the 27th, we would be ready to bring that back to you. That was kind of our initial timeline. So we'd probably be able to share with you what that would look like around that time period. And we'd release that separately.
And being a pilot, it would be not only authorized by the city council, but then evaluated before it was promulgated as a standard operating procedure. So for that reason, we would probably want to do it in the first 2 years of the expenditure schedule so that we could time it with any constitutional amendments that may take effect later in the five-year cycle, so that we experiment early and make our lessons known before the funds are all obligated.
John?
I was just going to say really fast, it came up numerous times during the public testimony portion on October 11th, so folks are definitely thinking about this a lot.
Yeah, everywhere I go, people remind me how they can build for so much cheaper than the city can, and I can build units for $20,000 a piece. Just give us the...
Wow, okay.
So
go ahead.
So this RFI doesn't preclude the turnkey concept, but it also isn't asking for the turnkey.
It's separate, because this is
it would be separate.
120 days, so
right.
You couldn't do it.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you guys are working in tandem on that.
Right.
So I guess my question was really around whether you thought people would apply, but it sounds like they already know there's going to be a turnkey thing, so people aren't going to go into this.
Okay.
Yeah, no, this is really trying to look for raw land or potentially existing buildings. I mean, someone could give us a building that has not yet been tenanted up.
But hopefully they know about the turnkey, and so they're
right,
not
that's
wasting
right.
their time on this.
Right.
They know that's
right. I mean, originally we thought we may be able to put all three of them there, but
yeah.
As we were having further conversations around turnkey, there was no way that it would be timely
okay.
that it would work.
Any other questions from the committee? Jess, you look like you've got something.
I wasn't sure if you were finished.
Yes.
Okay. I have two questions. You ran through some costs per unit
yes.
before we started here, but will you, I see
not,
here $160,000 or less.
Yeah, it's not in there. So there's stuff you can't see here, which is in the submitted, sorry, oh, yeah, thank you. So there's a set of submittal requirements here, and this Form G is where those numbers are. So you can't.
If you look at if you look at page 4, it says existing building, and it, the second bullet refers to Form G.
So it's here. So it's okay. It's the same one
and
we
that's
just
form,
used.
And so that,
yeah. We just don't have Form G, is what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's on our website.
So,
so, this, so this link goes to it.
And that's the average cost per unit.
Of, or is that the maximum cost?
That's the maximum cost.
Maximum cost, okay. Because that's just in the quick math, remembering from when we hashed out 1,300 units, way back when the math doesn't even remember from then, I know.
So that's
but
this
that
is
that
the,
was
this
that's
is the
a lot higher
yes.
in the acquisition than I think we had targeted.
It
so
is.
It looks like 160,000 is the goal. In acquisition, though we're willing to go up to this high. Okay, thank you for clarifying.
So those are numbers there.
Okay.
And we want them to use the tool, and we'll use it if they don't. It just gives you, you know, calculates simple math there, the number of units.
It says develop cost, but I think it's more along the lines of with the total cost.
Oh.
My second question is maybe inappropriate, but hey, it's Friday. I thought there was strategic reason that when acquiring land, we wouldn't want to announce ourselves as the government coming to buy land because the costs go up when negotiating. And so how does an RFI work in that context? And it's so different than how we acquired the Ellington. If you could just give a little bit of background context.
Sure. You know, in any type of acquisitions, we do appraisals. Right, and so regardless as to what they're proposing to sell it to the Bureau, if there is a price, we will do an appraisal, and sometimes we do overpay beyond what the appraised value based on conditions. So that's how we would assess whether we want to move forward on their proposal or not. Because yes, if we've gotten many proposals that says, you know, buy this property in over in Northwest Portland, and it's a great site, but it's $50 million, and doesn't make any sense. But we will do an appraisal.
But we can buy properties on assignment from somebody else that already has something on a contract. But as a matter of practice, it's called a shield buyer. You know, as a matter of practice, government, at least this government, won't be using shield buyers to buy real estate. But if somebody already has a property under contract, they want to assign that contract to us under the same terms and conditions, take an assignment fee, we would consider that, and we bought property under those terms and circumstances already. But it's hard to, I think, from a public disclosure standpoint, since realtors are obviously in this business, it's hard for us to say that we would make a practice out of creating a artificial entity or some other shill purchaser to deceive the seller. If sellers all want to know who the buyer is ultimately likely to be.
Well, Jess, I think as Javier mentioned earlier, we don't think this is the only way we're going to seek to acquire properties, but partially because we've had so many people say, oh, I've got this stuff, we're officially opening the window for people to entertain offers. And they may, you know, we are unsure as to how that we'll get what we are seeking out of this, but this at least gives an opportunity and some real criteria for people to apply to that. I think we'll also become a lot more strategic. You know, this may yield some results, but we're probably not likely to keep this in this form exactly because, you know, as we start to look at, okay, we've done something maybe in Southeast, now we're really looking at a property in this location or this part of the city based on our geographic overlay that, you know, that we've been asked to make sure that we're touching every part of the city with our bond investments. I think you'll see us become a lot more strategic as well. But we did feel like we needed to have an open window. We get quite a bit of number of emails from people wanting to sell us
yep.
their stuff.
All the time.
So,
or
people
stuff.
Riding bikes who say that's a great property,
buy
go
stuff.
Buy that one.
What are we doing around engaging with public sector entities that own property? PPS and county, the two biggest property owners. I pass PPS properties. That would be Kenton School. I'll just throw that out there. It's transit or development. There could be 200-300 units there. I feel like politically we've been talking about this crisis, but to me, I only see a couple bureaus being impacted by this crisis as opposed to I think there's an opportunity with some political work to have the county and the city go go and say, look, we're all being impacted like this. I need every bureau, every public agency to give up two or three properties or two or three ideas on properties where we could put housing, because I'm with you when it comes to us acquiring property, it's going to be expensive. And so to be able to get some properties on the cheap or for nothing or for some horse trading or some whatever we need to do, I think we have to be talking about that. Otherwise, I believe it just opens us up for people in the general public to be like, what the hell? Why are you paying rich guy over here for his property when PPS has something that's been vacant for 30 years and it'll probably be vacant another 30 years?
Well, PPS will not come cheap. I mean,
that's what I was going
to
say. I mean,
well, again, I think there needs to be like some political sway there, Kairos, to have things happen that maybe weren't going to happen otherwise, right? And say, all right, this is for the best of everyone at the end of the day. And if they get a little less than what they could have gotten, I just think all ideas have to be on the table, and you have to be proactive about those kind of things. I don't think people are just going to show up and be like, oh, hey, we got these three properties.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, continue to have conversations with public agencies, Metro, PPS, the county, the city, bureaus, and we will continue to try, Matt, and we will continue to do that, and we're doing some of that. The challenge, and I would say, I think it's a misconception that because it's publicly owned property, that it's going to be cheap, and it's not. I mean, even when we bought the property that we bought on 60 to start from Parks, we paid appraisal value for that. I mean, we did an appraisal, joint appraisal, and that's what we paid, because then you're going to look at those resources to be able to reutilize them somewhere else. So that's the challenge. So it's not going to be cheap. It's going to be whatever based on market value, appraised value, which is different than in the market, where you may end up having to pay a premium from the appraise because of where it is or what the interest is. But it's not going to be cheap. That's why I make sure I put that point out there, that any public property, it's not going to be cheap.
Excellent conversation. It was something specifically to the RFI. Yeah. The only reason why I ask is just in light of our time, wanting to be true to what we're allocated. So yes, sir.
I actually have a number of things. So I want to share how we're going to go through this, but. Yeah. So the main area is around the way we talk about the geography, so the location criteria. So it's reflected both in the introduction and also in the table. So we say seeks to focus resources geographically, and it has two bullet points that say areas of high risk for gentrification and high opportunity areas. But there's actually, I actually asked Jennifer for this chart, there's a difference between building acquisition and land acquisition and where we're targeting geographically. So I don't know if we need to reflect that there, and then also in the table. So in the introduction, that's the bullet points within the table, and it's actually in the preferences for displacement and vulnerability rating and then opportunity map score. It shows them both the same in the building acquisition and the land acquisition columns. So I think they're actually opposite, right? I think the building acquisition relies on the vulnerability score, and the land acquisition relies on the opportunity score. So I think we want building acquisition in high vulnerability and land acquisition in high opportunity. It's not precluding the other ones, but I'm not sure anyone will reflect
that. But that's the key comment, it's not precluding the other ones, right? So, you know, you're thinking back to our quadrant map, right?
Yeah.
So just to sort of frame up with this thing, A, it's preferences.
Yeah.
And then B, we would apply a secondary sort of overlay to it, which would get it exactly what you said. Yeah.
And
so this is sort of like the minimum.
The minimum. So I'm just wondering if up front to attract folks so they understand what we're looking for, whether or not we need it. So they need to go to the framework and really understand the framework to make sure that they're hitting the mark at the highest points.
And I think, you know, we say framework, I don't know, you know, a dozen times in here, right? I mean, the crucial thing around this is that people, if all you do is say, I want to sell you a piece of property, and you look at this, and you're not really understanding the background behind this, we may not really even want to, you know, work with you, per se, right?
Okay.
Because that's really how we're going to make our decisions, based on what's in the framework.
Okay, perfect. And that's kind of what I thought, but I wasn't sure if it needed to be reflected in those pieces. So also on the table, I was just a little bit confused about the, I think it's a punctuation thing, where it says residential housing units under building acquisition. It says 50, and then period, more is preferred. So I think that just was what it literally means, right? That the preference is for more than 50.
Well, so, you know, going back over this, so the minimum is 20, right?
Right.
And there's a big delta, obviously, between 20 and 50, right?
Yep.
What we're trying to communicate there is that, you know, we really aren't interested. Yes, we'll accept, we'll look at 20 or 20, certainly, but the Bureau is really interested in a bigger building.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to leave the table because I get what you're getting at.
Okay. And just so you know, the reason for that is that the really small projects don't have enough cash flow to support on-site management. And so many of our populations benefit from on-site management. It's not just, it's not for our administrative convenience, although there is some administrative convenience with size, but it's really the quality of resident services that you can afford in a larger property than a smaller.
That we can leverage that size of the building to bring in services. And then the exclusion criteria talks about the environmental remediation.
Mm-hmm.
So it has environmental remediation in the buildings of 10,000 per unit or more, within the land of 1 million or more. So there's a difference between those two. I'm assuming it's purposeful.
Yeah, so I guess if you just sort of multiplied, you know, 50 times 10,000, right.
Right,
you get a couple of $500,000.
Right,
yeah.
which is a lower threshold than the land. And I guess the assumption is that a building on a piece of property would have already gone through a remediation process,
yeah, exactly,
rather than a piece of land. We want to make sure we're not stuck with
right. Yeah. The
remediation.
Yeah, I mean, if there's a $500,000 worth of environmental remediation
on
a
building,
we don't want it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a very high, you know, high number.
Yeah, because you might, yeah, that'd be bad. And then the final piece in the actual selection and process, is there going to be a scoring and weighting formula for these? Okay, that appears in some of the attachments or something.
Yep.
So,
was that a yes?
Yes. So there's something you haven't seen yet. There's a form that everyone's supposed to fill out that's got all these, not just these criteria here, but a whole bunch of other property information. And so that will be in a database that we can just simply go, okay, here's your opportunity score, here's your vulnerability score, here's your school catchment area, and it'll all be in a database that we can just go, okay.
And just pop out there. Okay. And will the highest weighting be towards the framework? Because there's three things there. Responsiveness to the framework, project requirements, and then preference criteria.
I'm going to let somebody else answer that question.
I think it's a combination of all, very honestly. I don't think we can say, yes, it's because within the framework covers all of it, right? But
right.
Within the framework, there's a lot of different options that, depending as to what that proposal, that
okay.
submittal looks like, and not only that individual submittal, but also in relation to anything else that we may be funding, that we have to make sure we have this balance between family size units, studios,
that's
all
right.
those things.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's different than just scoring a regular
right.
RFP
right.
that
right.
comes in the door. We can't just
exactly.
say, this is the winner.
Exactly.
Okay. Right. Yeah, it sort of flips our typical multiple on its head, right? Where they're sort of competing against each other, right? Here it's, you know, it's on us to sort of decide which ones we want to go with.
Yeah, and we're trying to respond to a need also in that context. Okay, great. Thank you. So much.
Excellent. Great questions. Anyone else from the RFI?
Jess had her thing.
Oh, Jess. And then Todd, too.
Todd, do you want to go?
Go ahead.
Okay. When the proposals flow in, we're not required to accept any of them, right? It's
no.
just, okay. But if there are proposals that you're quite interested in pursuing and maybe even mm-hmm. offering, then they will come back to this table, just like 30th and how
yeah, we're going to go through that in just a minute when we get through the RFI.
Okay, great.
But henceforth, I would recommend that we do this every year because there will be people who in 6 months say they never knew that the city was interested in buying $200 million worth of property, and why is it that one developer is getting good deals from the city? So it's incumbent on us to recognize that not everybody is connected to the city, and we do this annually, and we recognize that we may only get 5% of the properties that are proffered to us are actually something that we pursue, because we still need to be cognizant that they may not be where we want them to be. We might have to do more direct outreach for specific sites, public agency outreach, that sort of thing. But we need to do this at least annually to hold that transparent.
And then my second is a comment that I guess I would just underscore Alan's question and comment about opportunities mapping and vulnerability mapping, and that the scoring is the same on both. Sort of continues that confusion that we struggled with a lot in the stakeholder advisory group, and because this is a preference section, it seems to be meaningful to not exclude any proposal, but to be clear, a preference for opportunity in the land acquisition and a preference for vulnerability in the building acquisition. Because I'm assuming this criteria or preferences will be used in the scoring, and so just being clear up front about that preference would, I think, be meaningful.
So we've heard this comment now from both of you that we're on the SAG, and it seems like
we'll figure out how to frame it.
We may want to. I mean, I'm just may I offer? I mean, maybe we just delete the vulnerability score out of the land acquisition portion.
Yes.
And just so that it's actually NA for that, and then at the opportunity map scoring for the existing building, remove 3 or higher.
Yes.
And put an NA there, and leave the opportunity map scores 3 or higher for the land acquisition.
Let me think about that. I think not excluding anything is my first criteria. I hear what you're saying. Maybe there's a way to say both. Maybe there's a way to, because I want to make sure that people are aware that we're using both of those indicators. That will, you know, respecting what the SAG said, right? Is that we'll use, you know, one or the other depending on what it is, right? That the vulnerabilities are support for buildings and the opportunities are support for the land, right? But I also don't want to give the impression that we're excluding opportunities for either one where the opposite's true, right? So I want to be able to say it without having to delete it.
Just in the worst base case scenario, let's say that we get 8 properties that just meet all this, and we're able to say this is excellent, this is what we want to move forward with, then it'll be the 8 apartment complex that we move forward that may not have met that one of that for those preferences. So having that flexibility, I guess, is important. Understanding that as we evaluate them, we have to bring that balance forward.
Well, so let me see if we can get some wording in there.
Do you want to work?
That leaves the graphic the same, but adds the clarity that you're looking for.
Do you want to work on that while I know Todd had a couple comments too. Maybe we can work on that while we talk about the process, because I'd like us to all feel comfortable with the RFI since we're releasing it on Monday morning.
Go ahead, Todd.
Sure. I guess my question, and maybe it'll be answered in the process portion, but I want to go back to the selection process and evaluation criteria. One thing that I can kind of tell, it seems like the process makes sense for me when there's a building, but then when you're looking at land acquisition, the comment about how there's always people emailing saying, hey, you should buy my property, like the, how do you separate the wheat from the chaff from all of these, like, just that's just blank land. Where, you know, when you have a building, it's like there's just clearly so many more steps that a landowner or a property owner would know before, like, that their property would be, like, in consideration. Or it's like anybody with a vacant lot could like propose something. So I guess my question is, if you could explain the process from somebody, like, from the perspective, how would that work for just somebody who has a lot, one of those folks that is emailing saying, you should buy my property? Do they have to do anything, or do they just say, I'm just filling this out and here's my number?
Okay, that's
it. It goes through these project compliance preference criteria, and then...
Because you're going to explain the process.
Yeah, and then we do a really deep dive into the properties, we'll talk a little bit about how we're going to do that internal process. If you're comfortable, maybe Carl can work on that language that we've all identified, and we can start to move to the other portions, and then if you have other questions, we can go back. Because I think what we're trying to show you today is a little of the internal process, and then with 30th and Powell, what the end result would be. So you can kind of see how we think this is going to look. Is everybody okay with that?
I think so, yeah.
So you have a one-page handout in front of you. It's entitled The Proposed Bond Property Assessment Internal Process. And, I did it down below, but I didn't do it above. What I'm noticing is that I did not, I used the acronym for the HIP team, which I had to even look up what it was.
Housing Investment Portfolio Preservation.
Yeah, I know, but I didn't know it off the top of my head. So
what we're proposing to do, after talking with what we like to refer to ourselves as Team Bond, an internal bond work group, is we would have.
I said not very hip.
Well, you know.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I'm like,
So it's the Housing Investment Preservation and Programs team, which is actually Carl and his team, who will be receiving these initial proposals for property. Our data team, who actually will be doing the assessments based on all of the SAG framework, and policy team. When I say policy team, I'm specifically looking at Jennifer Chang, who was the lead policy person in developing the stakeholder advisory group framework, who has the most intimate knowledge and all of the details, will be doing an initial review whether the properties meet the basic criteria. And for those of you who attended the stakeholder advisory group meetings, you'll remember the red light, green light, yellow light process. And we're kind of going to bring that forward into the project proposal. So, you know, we don't know exactly what we're going to get, what this is going to look like, but we know that there'll be some red lights, right? That don't meet our criteria, you know, really expensive or just in really bad shape. I mean, you know, whatever it may be, we think there's going to be a clear red pile.
There's also a moral hazard. If somebody hasn't paid their property taxes for the last 3 years on all their other property, we would probably not consider rewarding them with a big paycheck, you know, because that creates a moral hazard about rewarding them.
Okay.
Well,
I'm
a big story.
We would then bring those, so when we get a yellow or a green light, what we'd be proposing is that we have above, I will note that Home Forward, we're planning on including on that panel. Home Forward is also going to be working with us on a variety of different aspects of the bond, but also primarily they're bringing rent assistance to this through their voucher program, and they're going to layer on vouchers. So where we build and where we acquire is really important for them with the voucher layer, because everything we do is going to have some vouchers in it. We would then have a standing committee, and you can see the members, the director, the assistant directors, the business operations manager, the finance and accounting manager, the HIP program manager, that's Carl, data manager, equity and policy manager, representative of Home Forward. You'll notice there's a little I there, and potentially a representative of our office and management of finance will be working with us on the actual financial end of making the bonds work. I want to go back to talking about the I in a minute. We would then do a standing committee meeting on Fridays. We'd be looking for a weekly time. We would anticipate that we could do this in person, by phone, or if people couldn't attend, by email in advance. The standing committee, we would be working toward a consensus with the standing committee. And I think we have to, when we convene that committee, we'll have to talk about what the definition of consensus means. But for many of us, it meant, in talking about this, that we felt we could live with this property, that there's no great red, you know, flags coming up, that there's no big, oh no, that is absolutely the wrong thing. So we can talk a little, this is just our internal dialogue. If their proposals were not given to us on a Monday, they would not be considered on a Friday. This is something that's important to us internally, because we need to be able to have the time to analyze these proposals. If for some reason the standing committee wasn't able to move the proposal forward or not, they could request additional information or lead to the next week. We also realize that some of these proposals may be very time sensitive, but we're going to have to work through that. If we had documented disagreements on that standing committee but still felt like there was a large majority of the group that felt like we should really consider that, we'd bring that to the executive leadership level, which is Javier, myself, obviously the director, and Leslie Goodlow. We needed to come up with something. We would then be hoping that we'd at least have, before we that group would be reach consensus, go back to the standing committee, but we'd be going to the mayor from that level forward. So do you have questions about that before I talk about the I?
Who is the I?
But the representative of the bond oversight committee.
Right. Is that what you mean? You're going to talk about that? I'm just going to. Yes.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
About the composition of the standing committee.
Uh-huh.
I noticed there's not a rep from the mayor's office. I know it comes in later at the end, but I don't know if it would be helpful to have that person in that mix earlier. I don't want to volunteer anybody else for a weekly meeting, but
yeah.
It seems like having them early in the process.
Yeah.
Jess?
I think my only comment was that working towards consensus seems ideal and sometimes hard. And the challenge, I would hope for some sort of what happens if it's home forward or the I, someone from this team table, blocking, not providing consensus. And then for the decision to go back to the leadership of PHB feels like it could create some tension about the role, the relationship with Home Forward, the relationship with this table.
Mm-hmm.
So consideration of that ahead of time if the blocking of consensus is coming from one of those partners.
I think that both of those would have an extreme amount of weight to any decision. I imagine that we would be moving forward and especially would have a lot of consideration again with the mayor's office. So I do realize that we're setting, you know, we're trying with the process on something we haven't done, but we're trying to consider factors in case there is a disagreement. But yes, I would think that both of those two may have a little bit more weight than others. And we haven't gotten there yet, but yeah, I think it's a valid thing for us to consider.
Chair?
I'm good.
Okay. You have any questions about that? If you'll talk to us about the eye.
So when thinking about setting up this committee, we were mindful, quite frankly, of what has been achieved with, I don't want to speak for the North and Northeast Oversight Committee since we actually have the chair with us here today, but there have been.
You can talk about us. That's okay.
Okay. So early on, there were some.
Just throw everybody under the bus. Yeah.
So having a member of the oversight committee on the NOFA evaluation panels, I think, has been a very good connection to making sure that there's a connection to the oversight committee, There are similar constraints, not precisely the same, but similar constraints with the North and Northeast Committee and the meeting schedule about being able to include everybody at every decision level. Sometimes people are conflicted. There are a variety of different things that come up. You don't have that same conflict, but just in terms of timing, we know that we don't think that having a weekly meeting with this body, nor have we, you know, we've been clear from the outset that that once the framework was set, your job is to kind of hold our feet to the fire, but not necessarily to be making the decisions for the Bureau. However, we really feel like having representation from this committee would be helpful to us. So what we were pondering or thinking about and want to discuss with you was whether we could work on a schedule with you maybe on a rotating basis with each member, that, you know, maybe you commit to a month with us and then we rotate off. I can't even guarantee we'd have meetings every week. We really don't know, but we'd be asking folks to hold that. I'd, of course, be open to whatever suggestions you have if you want to participate in this manner as a committee, but that was our first thought for the little eye.
I do think there will be a surge of initial interest as the great, it's a big funnel, right? So we're trying to Todd's point, we're going to narrow everything down to the vital few. We're going to see a lot of things for the first time, probably between November 1st and March, I would think. Partly because, you know, we're mindful that November 8th will be the 1-year anniversary of the approval of the bond, and we sort of need to show movement. Create a pipeline, and given the 120-day review, those all need to move to close in an expeditious manner. So this is one case where the holidays, as last year when we were doing due diligence on the Ellington during the holidays, you know, we're not going to be taking a lot of time on that. Just so you know, and I think it actually come spring, I think it'll actually slow down.
So my thought, and I don't want to preclude anyone, but a thought to address it is, in terms of rotation, two things come to mind. One is, how do you make sure you're communicating among yourselves what's going on? And then in terms of rotation, if it's first, third, fifth, Friday, you know, who's got the first, who's got the second, who's got the third, which would not then make anyone have to be concentrated any specific monthly time. You would just have second Fridays of every month, and you first Fridays of every month, and third Fridays of every month. It's one way to disseminate it. And the other, of course, is to, since you have a chair and a vice chair, kind of put it into the hands of delegation. So those are just my suggestions, things to think about. Chair, sir.
So it sounds like it's a pretty flexible way of participating. So either in person or via email or phone call, correct? Mm-hmm. And we would have at least those four days to review things. I will throw a curveball and say, we all have different backgrounds here, mm-hmm. and I would say I would love for there to be two representatives on it, and people commit to these are going to be the two for this month or for these 2 months or whatever. So, and then we say, okay, if we get this email, I know I got until Friday to provide my feedback. I feel like we have such, you know, a good makeup here of like third baseman, catcher, pitcher kind of thing, that I think it does a disservice to that, to just having one participant. So I throw out there a commitment to having two people be on the ball and participate with that. However that gets cut and dry, it makes no never mind to me. But I think that would give us a little bit more well-rounded look at it, as long as, again, we have the willingness to commit to doing that and then doing it. So I throw that idea out.
Susan, you've been rather relatively silent.
Well, I would say of the five of us, just in thinking about that kind of responsibility, I'm probably the least prepared to look at proposals. I mean, I think where my interest and my strong suit is to be able to say, what's the affordability going to be, and always to be bringing that up in terms of who is going to be able to live there, and that we stay true to developing these units for people at 30% of median or less. So I don't think I'd be very comfortable being the sole representative of this group. The other people are just so much more experienced and knowledgeable about development and looking at the whole package, I feel like.
Well, you're on the oversight committee because you bring insight, yeah. Leverage, and weight. So I appreciate the humility of it, but I think there's value in everyone weighing on. Todd, your thoughts? Look like your wills are
I'm like, I don't know if it's a race to the bottom.
But. Let me get mine in first.
I think I'm willing to share the responsibility. I think that's better to have multiple voices. The time commitments, I think, are what for just that's immediately right. what pops out to me is kind of just how many hours is a Friday meeting going to be? What is it going to be? And, I know it's hard. I guess it's hard.
It's hard to know. You know, without you know, some meetings there may be just one project. Some there might be, you know, who knows? It doesn't.
That's my main interpretation. It's just having a regular adding another. If it's like, you know, if it turns out that these happen to be like 4 or 5 hour meetings, it's going to be harder.
I think what we can say is, so, you know, we will distill information through this process or whatever other additional process that there's a, you know, a standardized format.
Yeah.
We'll have done the internal analysis first. So, you know, we can give you something that's fairly condensed that you can look at. You know, the number, you know, obviously we can't control that per se, but we can certainly give you information that's easily digestible, relatively easily digestible.
You know, I would also recommend, I don't think any of us have a problem with doing the two members of the BOC. Since we're not going to be, we won't be looking to schedule anything to the 1st of November, I think we can also take some time with you for some comments about how if you want to trade off with the scheduling. I mean, if you
you'd like us to try to, I don't imagine we're going to have things right the first week. I mean, we will be getting things on the 23rd, but this analysis is not going to be, you know, I don't think we'll, maybe the second week of November. I mean, I'm starting with the concept of November 4th.
I think mid-November we'll have something to say.
Right. And then we'll meet the day after Thanksgiving. No, I know.
That's a Friday.
No, I know.
And we're asleep that day too. So,
so do you like the concept? It sounds like we like the concept of two members. We would agree to maybe look at a staggering schedule with everybody. Try to keep the meet. I mean, you know, 12 buildings though, Carl. I mean, that 12 parcels is that's. That's the end of our bond money. I mean, in one.
Well, we're only evaluating potential opportunities here, right?
Right.
Yeah. So you guys are doing a first sieve already. So we're not looking at everything, right?
Yep.
Right.
No.
You guys are working with a lot more information than we are. I think
right. The
other thing that will help for us going forward is an ongoing dashboard of
that's the same thing.
How are we doing so far? Yeah.
Right.
So that when. You know, we're three deals in. All right, do we need more 2 and 3 bedrooms? Do we need more 30%? Or are we doing really, really good?
Yeah.
I think those are the kind of things that are going to really be helpful for us. But at the end of the day, you guys have 90% more information than we're ever going to have.
And our data team has talked about mapping when every proposal comes in where those are so that we can get a general geographic sense versus everything else. So. We hope to make this a streamlined process for you, which I think you'll see a little bit of the information next on the 30th in Powell. This Friday, I mean, Friday morning is generally our thought at a certain time. Two members work to stack. Do you like Bishop Holt's idea, Dr. Holt's idea of staggering every other, so not a month block, but staggering a little bit or...
I imagine it's going to be really heavy for 2 or 3 weeks, and then it's going to be a trickle. So I don't think that's going to be a huge thing. That's my thought. I mean, Carl, what do you think of how it's going to come in?
I think that's right.
And there's no concern about consistency between meetings, right? Because it's new properties every single meeting, so you don't need to be at the.
If we had a reason that we had questions that were needing to be answered, we'd address those with the panel members that I would assume, right, that we wouldn't swap you in for a second conversation.
Yeah.
We'd have to address that with the panel members that were on that panel.
Right. Yeah, but to Stephen's point, as we jointly expand the funds, it's going to be a narrower focus. In other words, you're going to start saying, okay, we need to ramp it up on the studios to get to our 300 PSH units, or we need to ramp up some more 3 bedrooms. So, you know, as the pipeline develops, it'll start to shape the strategy, you know.
And are we going to share that publicly at all? I mean,
no,
I think that
what?
Some sort of like dashboard that people in the public could generally kind of
see,
of here's kind of how we're doing.
Oh, yes, yes.
That'll be on the website.
Yeah, I mean, I could even see like a separate website where it's just like, it's 3 a.m, I want to see the dashboard.
Well,
oh,
you know what?
I already got it.
Go to trollinghousingbond.com.
And it's got the beginnings of a dashboard
on it.
Yeah, it's not quite as advanced as it will be, but it's the beginnings. Yes.
Look at that.
These folks, huh?
Actually, and I will have you know that I'm very proud of the Martha Calhoun and our public information officer's work. She had a photographer go out and take pictures of actual Ellington residents. So. We have pictures of the Ellington and people who are actually living at the Ellington on the website.
Awesome.
So they are not.
All right. So where do I find this?
At portlandhousingbond.com.
Portlandhousingbond.com.
Yeah.
So in relationship to time.
Yeah, I guess in that vein, I was wondering if you would want to have like community advocacy groups as part of this. I mean, you talk about like as Stephen mentioned, holding 90% of the information. And then going through this process, there's that sense of like gatekeeping information. And if this isn't, I don't know if this is a public meeting or not, but if folks come to the bond oversight public meetings and say, well, where'd you come up with these projects? And like, oh, we had another meeting where we selected from all of the projects. And I think.
Well, see, the beauty of that is that you're already sort of free of conflict of interest. And the problem when you expand to 10, then suddenly you have people with inherent conflicts of interest. You know, they're either on boards of nonprofits that are doing business with the city that have financial remuneration attached to it, or they own property, or they are connected to people that own property. And it really starts to become a moral hazard there, I think.
I think to Todd's point, it just becomes incumbent upon making that part of the disclosure of your meetings.
Yeah,
I would say in the opening, right?
On the website, it says we're an open book. So I just want to highlight if there's some criticism. I don't know if maybe it would be somebody from the stakeholder advisory committee, representative of that or something. But I just think that could be.
Don't you have two?
We do on this board on this, right. But if we're not there, those two don't happen to be at this meeting.
Well, and the SAG did have conflicts of interest. That's one of the reasons why we separated their work.
Well, and we have talked about this process, not in with this detail, but we have talked about the fact that the acquisitions of the buildings would not be something that we'd be necessarily doing in a public setting. People won't submit buildings or documentation. I mean, the kind of things we're going to be getting are financials, whether things are in the market. You know, we're trying to use a little bit similar to a NOFA process where we have an external and an internal process. It's a little different because we are expecting some things on a potentially weekly basis in the beginning. As you said, it probably won't be that extensive later on. I mean, I think we could talk about expanding the group or changing the makeup of the group. I think after we get through this initial wave, possibly, and we know that we're going to have, maybe not, we won't need a weekly standing meeting, we'll have more of an idea of it. You know, I think we're willing to consider it, but it does present quite a few issues, and none with not wanting to be transparent, but that's kind of what the SAG process was laying out for us, is these are the criteria we need you to make a professional assessment on as a bureau and set the policy. And, you know, it has to ultimately go to council. I mean, these decisions are not going to be publicly vetted. You know, it's not like we'll just buy them and then it won't go anywhere. But people will know what we're basing the criteria on.
The other thing I'd like to mention, Alan, your point about the mayor's office, we meet every week with the mayor's office, and in property acquisition, we float to the mayor and the mayor's staff, including the chief of staff, Bureau liaisons, the housing policy advisors all see that material. And most of the conversation when it gets to that level has to do with the neighborhood and the community messaging. So, I mean, they're gonna see this, the outputs of this process. Whether or not they wanna loop in, I mean, I don't think we have a problem with them being informed more early. We have a hot sheet that we put out every week. I meet with the mayor's chief of staff every week, meet with the mayor every week. That's three touches. So yes. Something usually, if it's a hot issue, we can usually make sure they know.
Yeah, my thought was just as far as process, you know, the ability for them to hear those conversations. That were
I think we'd invite them, yeah, and if they wanted to participate.
So we got to go to Carl.
Yeah, right.
Carl's got a date.
Yeah.
Just real quick question. Did you want to select? Who? Or you want to postpone that?
Pretend we don't have that responsibility.
I'll be one of the two.
Yeah, no, of course. But we have time.
Okay. I think we do have time.
At least a few weeks.
Yes.
I mean, Susan, do you really not want to participate? I guess that was the one thing I'd like to know, is if you'd like us just to work with the other five members. I mean, I think these are going to be occupied buildings, many of them, with people in them.
If there are two of us, I feel comfortable doing that.
Excellent. Thank you.
So we are at what?
4:35.
Okay, and we don't have any public comment. We have no one here, so.
All right.
We've got a few more moments, my friend. It is on you.
Okay.
10 minutes with Carl, and then Javier will take over from there.
Okay.
Not anybody.
So, I assume all of you are aware that PHP bought this property at 3000 South East Powell. Is anybody not aware of that?
You're not aware of
it. Is this the one that was in the media about shelter going in it as a temporary?
Yes. So I'll get to that in a second. So, anyway, so PHP now owns this property. It's hard to see here. I guess the light's
Do you want me to turn the lights on?
So we close on this property in September 25th, after about a year's worth of due diligence. This is not the best map here, but this would be Powell Boulevard and 30th Avenue there, approximately there. And the site here is, again, Powell. And I'll go into a few more details about what's here, but the strip club is here, and that's formerly called the Safari Club, no longer. And you can see I wanted to have up here the Opportunity Map Store, so it's worked really well. Opportunity Map Store and the Vulnerability Store. I think it was interesting when I looked at the Vulnerability Map is by Census Tract, and this particular Census Tract is a little bit unique from the ones surrounding it. This one's a little bit higher on the Vulnerability Map. I think it's because of the affordable housing that's near here, that cafeteria zones. So it's sort of an interesting location. So like I said, we closed on the property on the 25th. The site's about 25,000 square feet. It's level and paved, as you probably can see. There's a building there. I don't know, these pictures came out great. These are the after pictures I have before on the computer, but just imagine a really skanky
building. Yeah.
It was pretty bad. So when we bought this, the previous owner didn't follow through on their lease obligations to clean it out, so it was an interesting moment when we walked in on the 26th and said, oh my God, what a mess. Anyway, it's much cleaner now. The building's actually in decent condition. It doesn't seem to be leaking, it doesn't seem to be, but heat works, air conditioning works, so we have talked about it as a shelter, which is one of the things we probably want to talk to you guys about, but that's been an idea. We did our usual due diligence, and this is, I think, something I want to get you guys familiar with. It's not that interesting, but that we're going to go through this due diligence process as we, after we say this is an initial thing we'll be looking at. These are the typical most important things that we'll do, so title, survey, environmental, and appraisal, not necessarily in that order. But I put them here a little bit by what's the most important for this site. It has some issues. It's got Terry Emmert is in the back. I don't know if anybody knows Terry, but he's a dude. And so we have some access issues that we'll have to take care of. 30th Avenue, which is on the west side of the site, needs to be vacated. This is my point in the RFI about cleaning up.
Yeah.
So we have pretty hefty cleanup there. And we negotiated the sales price. This was the original sales price, and we got the sell into a discount because that's probably based on that. So it's a fairly typical process that we'll go through, is to do all this stuff, sort of go back to the seller and say, here's what we found, are you willing to work with us on this, if this particular seller was. So,
the methane is a unlicensed landfill, so there's
stuff out there.
There's rotting material producing off-gassing methane, and you can build around it in some cases, but we estimated $500,000 to $1 million.
Yeah, so we'll end up probably taking off a significant amount of and disposing of it at probably regular landfill.
So can I pause you here for just a second on this? So when we're looking at the assessment for the process we just spoke about, we're going to be doing, we won't have done all of this. What you'll be seeing from us is kind of the early, what this package you have in front of you includes. Does it meet all of the policy scores? And then we'll go to here. So many of the properties you could potentially look at, we won't ever move forward because we find it a huge environmental issue that it makes no sense for us to move on. So just so this actually would be a, you don't expect to see this while you're serving on the panel.
I'm sorry,
yeah.
I'm moving slower than you, Carl. Is that why the price was reduced because of the soil contamination? Okay, great. And Emmert,
Terry Emmert is.
That has some access.
Yeah, so. So this site, the site here to the south is owned by Terry. In fact, there's a lot of other issues I won't go into details of, but the seller we bought this from used to own this site here, so it's Terry Emmert. Terry Emmert is sort of a notoriously pugnacious fellow. Stephen's kind of grinning there. So in the process of negotiating the sale process.
That one.
In the process of negotiating the sale, we just decided we're just gonna suck it up to deal with it. It's not gonna
be. So he's a neighbor.
He's a neighbor, he's also
He's got an
He's a notorious defect.
He has alternative. He has alternative access, though. This is a secondary access.
He's got an unrecorded easement.
Anyway, it's just going to be a thing.
Part of the thing I wanted to just to say about that is that, you know, Stephen's saying about we have 90% more information maybe than you guys know. A lot of the stuff around what takes so much time for us to do this are these kind of things, right? So we're going to have to vacate that easement. We're going to have a probably really contentious negotiation with Terry. So it's just one of the pieces of
So you mentioned the price was discounted for by $1 million for the environmental cleanup. Is that disqualifying for the RFI? Would that be disqualifying?
So because we said this was an estimate. Actually, our estimate was about $800,000, so it wouldn't disqualify.
So I guess what I'm saying is, so say it was $2 million, and then the property owner was like, okay, fine, I'll sell it to you for $2 million less. Is that all we want to do?
$2 million worth of cleanup. I think that's really the question.
It's on orders of magnitude as well.
Because if it needs $2 million of cleanup, there's probably other things that got missed.
That's just a huge number. I mean, $2 million of cleanup was site. I mean, typically site costs are $100,000.
It also means time for us. Money means time. So the larger the scope of the environmental issue, the larger the cleanup time, the longer the lead time we'd have to deliver on our affordable housing goals. So, I mean, even if we wanted to undertake something of that magnitude, we'd just be drying ourselves out.
All right, so the zone, this is kind of an interesting question. So the current zoning, which will change in January, is the general commercial. Going to central employment doesn't help us as much as it needs to, based on what you could build on the site. So I sent a letter, Kurt signed, to the Planning Bureau, asking them to go to this designation, which is commercial mixed use two with a design overlay. This allows us to go to 75 feet total, and gets us to a floor area ratio of 4. So we can have a fairly big building. I don't think the city is interested. So 75 feet tall, 6 or 7 stories. And could take up pretty much the whole site.
So one way I could see things not going well is, let's say Jess and I sell you our lot, and it's R1, and we do an appraisal, we get it based on R1, and then you go and get it rezoned to CM2.
Right.
Are we going to get more money? Or... I imagine that being a really bad article for
this
us.
This is a bit of a one-shot deal here. So this is through the map refinement project that's sort of a follow-on to the city's comprehensive plan. So the city's comp plan is that on January 1st, state is that January 1st, 2018, we did all that comp plan stuff, we changed the zoning throughout the city, and oops, we missed about 500 parcels.
Right.
So this is through that. I doubt we will very often want to rezone something, right? Because it's a much more expensive project.
Right.
And it's time consuming, it costs us money. That would be sort of really low.
But that'd be something we know in the process.
Because I think what I would point out is because CG doesn't appear, on the requirements.
That's because it's old. Yeah, so it says.
Yeah. Those are all going away. Those are all going away. Because CM is
the
new designation.
Okay.
Yeah,
there's
no CG anymore.
All right. So they'll all be changed to CMs.
Yeah.
Or CM2s.
So then my staff did a little bit of just the conceptual work that we'll be doing, with these properties. So based on the zoning, which I just spoke about, 210,000 roughly gross square feet. So we think that's about 200 units.
I think that it's just be ground floor, not ground flood. I don't think we're in a floodplain, but just so you know.
That is floodplain over there.
Judge,
pretty close to the line.
Yeah. Anyway, so my staff, just did some basic.
This is not architecture.
Not architecture, right? Just basic math.
Yeah.
What's it going to look like?
Is that
parking?
Yeah, it's a parking. Tuck under parking.
Cool.
And the orange part is
commercial.
Orange part, I mean, commercial parking.
67 parking, 200 units.
67 parking spaces. Perfect, right?
200 units was based on an estimate of about 1,000 square foot unit. So, this is not architecturally.
This is really rough.
But this is a good rule of thumb for you guys. You know, when you see the
some
total gross square footage,
some bigger, some
be
smaller, right? But generally, right? Yeah, that's
so just a nice thing to
keep. And we could we get more than 200 units if they, we went smaller than 1,000 square
feet? Yeah.
Okay.
So then, there's nothing there around potential cost per square foot.
No, I'm happy to talk to you about what we know about current cost per square foot, but this is just, we bought it, and here's how big we think it's going to be, and then we got to go through the whole development process.
And we'll come back, we would be coming back with you with architectural plans, layout, what we think we're going to be looking at programming. I mean, first blush thought is across from a high school, good school catchment area, that we'd try to do some family size, but that doesn't mean that that's the end of the conversation, but we would take all of this, go forth and do more work, right?
How does using it as a shelter figure in development? Would that be like
that
a seasonal?
That's a perfect question, Susan.
Seasonal.
Susan, you will have to. So here's a potential schedule. This is potentially already. So we would start immediately on the design process. And design is usually, you know, 12-ish months all the way through permits. And it's this says about 18 months to construct, right? So one of the things we've talked about is using a building as shelter. And one of the questions in here is if we start December 2018 on construction, we have to have the building there. So does it make sense to have the shelter there for only one season versus two? And that's kind of one of those internal questions that we're working on. So far, and you guys should comment on how where the county is or where the joint office is on using this as a shelter. But that's I'm going on the assumption that we'll use that building.
And did you say maybe we should delay, sorry, you didn't say this, but were you inferring maybe we would delay construction to extend shelter until the end of the rainy season?
Okay. I believe the mayor's office, and I think, you know, we're trying to look at least that schedule. I mean, I believe we're leaning, you know, realities of the shelter need, but also leaning toward trying to get a project on the ground as quick as possible for the bonds. And this is probably our, other than an acquisition strategy, or potentially turnkey, but even then, they'd still have to build. And there are, you know, timing realities of when you construct and when you do things and how long permits take. You know, this, I think we'd all like to see something coming online sooner than later. Because it means, you know, it means less people in shelter have housing.
The other point about shelters, because it's across the street from Cleveland High School, we made it clear at the outset that it wouldn't be a mass shelter suitable for single men coming out of some of the other shelters that are currently in operation. So because of that, the Joint Office of Homeless Services is redoubling their efforts at another location. And they have asked us to consider, the Multnomah County has a MacArthur Justice Grant for formerly incarcerated women who are under the full supervision of parole officers getting support services, and they need 25 units. So we are touring the property for that purpose. We think, you know, the population would be salient to the neighborhood. Catholic Charities is two blocks away. They have a family service center nearby. But it really hinges on whether or not they're willing to make the improvements for only maximum 24 months. They'll have to find another place.
So I wanted to do this for two reasons. One was to obviously talk to you about this particular parcel so that I'll hear your feedback on that, but also to give you a general idea of the process, the pieces of the process that we're going to go through. And you know, this is something that we're going to go through with not only internally, but hopefully with our partners as well. There's a way, way more stuff that's going to happen. So just a very preliminary kind of thing. So with that,
Carl's by
Forkin
for
his day. Everybody, thank you.
It's okay, I got another 5 minutes.
So, and what you have before you, too, is, although Carl, we have much more information on this project because it's actually gone, we've purchased it, we bought it, we've done all the full due diligence. What you'll see before you is a packet of what we think an analysis on properties that you would be serving on the internal review committee we talked about as the double I now, the two I's. This is kind of what the packet would look like based on what the SAG framework has laid out. So you'd know, you know, what the general property description is, what the construct, you know, whether it's new construction or building, whether it's a, you know, located in the city, minimum units, you know, price being offered, location, neighborhood census snapshot, opportunity mapping, to school catchment areas, and then in the back you can see all of the various pieces of data that we've pulled from publicly available documents on this particular property. So you can get a sense of what we think you'll be, you know, besides a full property description of what's being offered to us, what the work we would have done before we even get to the point of bringing it to you to say, do you, all of us, as joining the team bond internal process, do you want to green light this project? A couple of other things I wanted to point out to you about Powell. The acquisition price was paid by short-term rental revenue. Will be paid by. We anticipate by the short-term rental revenue bonds. We do not intend to use the affordable housing bond for that acquisition price. So we will be bringing over that land to pair with the bond from another funding source. So we'd be at least leveraging that portion of the development. So I did want you to know that, so that you don't think that we're going to try to repay ourselves to the affordable housing bond. We're going to use that other source of funds. And for those of you who don't know, the short-term rental revenue bonds will have similar but slightly different features of GO bonds. They do require some ownership constraints as well, so they are a good resource for us to pair with the affordable housing bond. It's not taking away from some other available source that could be used in our more traditional leveraged model that folks would be more used to seeing in the non-bond model.
So where in the process of pre-development, if you got to 200 units, would you decide the mix of affordability? Where would that come in?
That would be early on. I mean, as we begin, if this site moves forward for bond, as a bond project, then those discussions will be had within the team bond, and then brought to the oversight committee as to this is what we're thinking. Based on the massing, based on the conversations that we had in terms of the programming and in terms of the units, before we move forward.
Home Forward has a particular lens that they need to layer on this. They were intricately involved in our decision making around the Ellington and the 80 units of 0 to 30. They look at census tract data. There are overlays on vouchers that I can't even begin to describe here, but I know that Home Forward could do that if we had them here. But with every one of these buildings, we're going to be assessing against our overarching goal. So with that, I mean the deeply affordable and our PSH goals of reaching, you know, 300 PSH units or availability of permanent supportive housing units. So, you know, we would make internal recommendations, but we would bring this project back to you before those determinations are made.
With the dashboard that will kind of show kind of where are we at in terms of the goals that we have established for the bond.
I mean, I get that it isn't our role to discuss shelter, probably, but I think it would really be unfortunate to use the site of shelter and slow down your development. I mean, I know there's this tension in the community, but I think to get started with something that could be affordable housing and pitch that to the neighborhood and skip the shelter process for this property would be better, you know, given, you know, messaging to the community that we're really prioritizing building permanent affordable housing.
It might be a both and. It's a big parking lot right now. And the city has received a grant from the U.S. Conference of Mayors for 35 tiny homes built by Plantation Farms, and they need a place to put some of these tiny homes. So we could have a tiny home cluster on part of the parking lot and still demolish the building. So I'm not sure that it forecloses. One thing for sure, and when Javier and Michelle went to the Neighborhood Association to announce our purchase, they received an ovation. So not very often do we find neighborhoods that are that
is
willing
good.
To accept something
across from school.
And they've not been
across from school.
so
a big one too.
You know, we at least need to ask the question, because we have several shelters that are in temporary quarters and they're being contested where they're trying to put them. So we can't just assume that Hanson Shelter is closing, it'll be relocated. The Schleifel Furniture Store will close, it'll be relocated. You know, we just need to make sure that we're using the assets. assets properly. If we're only losing 4 months out of the schedule, it may not actually impair us.
Jess?
I did some quick Jess math, and I think it looks like at 3.2 million dividing by 200 units, dividing by $200,000 per unit, which is a rough, that we get to a, the land is about 8% of the cost of construction. And it's my understanding that land values can range drastically, but 10 to 15 is a good ballpark. So did I do that right? And is this theoretically a good affordable purchase for land?
Yeah, theoretically
so
it
we can develop on it.
When we get into design development, the 200 units, the amount of parking needed for the retail will all have to be right-sized. And you know, if we build smaller units, we could get more still and drive that number down.
So I just wanted to test my understanding of that quickly. And I have two more. Did you
But the price is actually closer to 4 million, right?
Once if you add in the
environmental cost.
Right.
Thank you.
I mean, I think that's what I was going to say. The price for square foot is a little bit.
But you know, it goes back to the number of units that you get on the site, right? So if it's going to cost you $500,000 to mitigate a site that you can only build 50, it's a different challenge than if you get 200 or 300 units on that site. So that's kind of where.
Even if it was more, still within the range of the purchases.
I can say that we've not found any urban land in Portland that doesn't have some remediation costs associated with it. So it's almost baked into the cake. Grand Warehouse, River Place Parcel 3, they all have remediation needs. It's all urban land.
Okay. I don't know what to do with that.
I think like you're saying, it's still within that range, though. Because it's a range. 8% is lower than 10 to 12.
Go to 15.
I don't know. It's up to 15.
Secondly, I wanted to just comment that I agree we should not be holding up construction for shelter purposes, though this seems like a wonderful opportunity to use this time of the vacant property. So I would hope perhaps there would be other opportunities like this to come along. I don't know how common it is to purchase land with a building that we want to destroy that's in good enough condition to.
but
there's probably opportunities to purchase land for tiny homes to be moved to in the pre-development phase. No, I don't know. It's worth considering that this model of temporary shelters in buildings that are being redeveloped has been used with private developers, and it seems like a good use for us, but I would really caution us from holding up development for the purpose of sheltering. And then last, I just wanted to make a comment about the process. This purchase seems really great, and we're here after the Ellington when that purchase was made prior to community process, and so I would hope that there's perhaps a role for this table to play in officially saying, yes, we've deemed this property a good, it fits with the framework, and we're approving it to be used as a property for constructing with bond dollars. I understand it's not being purchased with bond dollars, these bond dollars, but I think if it's going to be built with bond dollars, we should formally say it's gone through the community process and we agree that it should be used that way.
So I wondered about that too when we were talking about this agenda, because I do think we want your blessing. One of the issues we've just raised, though, in talking about a process is we're going to be making acquisitions without coming to this full table by involving you in a future process. So this does feel like a little bit of a one-off, and I want to bring that up, and not because I'm not looking for you to do an official vote, but because I want to be sure that you're aware that each time we buy something, we're not going to bring it back for you once we've gone down the road to say, I bless this project. You'll be looking at this to see why we did what we did. You'll be involved as individual members in the process of purchase, and you'll be helping guide us for especially the new developments, and how are we going to build the units? What is it going to look like? What are our goals with those properties? So I don't, you know, I just wanted to say I'm fine with that. I want to make sure that we don't, that there's no tension, and that we're fully understanding how the role of bond oversight committee is. And I think
I say that because I wasn't involved in this.
Exactly.
But it will be going forward. So maybe for this one, we should just.
Okay.
I think to that point, we signed up for making sure the SAG works. The work that the SAG did is in this. We are not the decision makers on the purchases or not. And so I think this is about kind of managing expectations going forward. And I don't know if we're ever going to have enough information to be like the stopgap. And so it's the difference, I think, between being informed and being accountable and being like a decision maker. I don't know if we'll ever have the information. I feel what you're saying. But I also, like, we need to be working with urgency. And the SAG did all this work, and we're assuming that staff is working with what the SAG did, and our role is to be kind of watching over that.
Just make sure. Yeah.
Otherwise, there would have been no reason to have the SAG do all the work that they did. My two points. My experience working with the city, temporary uses are always difficult because it's always easier not to have something and not have the political risk of, you know, because the worry is if you do a shelter, the community gets used to it, and then the newspapers, I mean, they're just trying to rake you over the coals no matter what. So that inevitable article of, oh, they're taking away a shelter, they're not going to go and say, hey, this was temporary, like, look, we were already doing a solid. That's not the way it's going to be constrained. So I agree with the two of you that if you can avoid doing the shelter or have that definitively ironed in there, it's going to be less on the back end because people are going to be like, why are you taking away my shelter? And then lastly, whatever we do with the dashboard, I would love to see how we're providing and supporting opportunities for MWSB firms along the whole process. So I didn't see on the dashboard right now anything that talks about, you know, I'd love to see a number on there about money going to M, W, and ESB. It's like three separate numbers.
Disaggregated.
And then when we get projects, I would love to hear, because there's going to be thousands of dollars on design, remediation, all that stuff. There's going to be a ton of opportunities for everyone's projects. And so I think those are all these little small wins that we should be talking about. And so...
Yeah, no, most definitely. We will closely track the M and the W in terms of everything that we're doing. Because this is conceptual, we don't have any of this.
No, I know. I'm just saying it's an opportunity for us to
celebrate. Would definitely, wins. That's definitely
it. Totally. I mean, get wins when you can, because it's going to take 2 years before this is built, so might as well have those contractors along the way that are like, yes. So,
Todd.
So I guess this is a question about not just this site, but any land acquisition. But when is the decision to about what type of housing is going to go in there going to be made? Is that a decision that we're involved with?
Yes.
Okay. How will that work?
So Javier, do you want to go into that? Because we're showing you a little bit of the massing here and what we think is going to happen. I would imagine that we can start to bring things back to you at meetings that you'll have about showing you what the unit mix that we're thinking of, why we're thinking of the unit mix. We're always going to be working towards all of our goals with the number of family size units that we have, where we think we're going. I mean, and be giving you that dashboard as well against where we already are. So like, for instance, the Ellington, it was a 200, and it's 263 units. We're only counting 219 units. We can go into that for a variety of different reasons of why we're doing that, but there were some affordability on the other units. All of those 219 units that we're bringing on are family size. So, you know, which is why we have a little dashboard around that. So, I mean, everything we do will be constantly checking against what we have done in the past, and I'm sure we will need to get more rigid, and you will need to get, well, as rigid as you want from the very beginning, but, you know, making sure we're getting all, hitting all of those goals. Certain properties, you know, the way you architecturally design buildings, and I'm not an architect, nor am I a developer, but over time I've realized that, you know, there are certain reasons we'll do things, even though you think you can get all three bedrooms, when you actually lay the building out, with the light wells that you have behind it, especially if you're in a downtown corridor or something where you've got, you have to do a different kind of building configuration because you end up with no windows if you try to do something along those lines. And then But we will be bringing back for you some conceptual ideas before we go to a full-blown architectural plan about what we're thinking. We'll be working with Home Forward very quickly on this project to make some initial assumptions. Again, I would say that you could see us doing some potentially, you'll see us doing a large number of family units everywhere, right, to meet our 50% of the unit goal. But I would anticipate we'll see quite a few family units in this building.
In addition to that, we're looking to move quickly on once decisions have been made. It's all relative as to quickly, right? Because when we talk about development, and the committee meets every 3 months, by the time that the committee is ready to meet, we'll have something to present that's a little tangible that we can see exactly how is it that we're moving forward. So that's kind of what I see in the process.
Denisha, would you mind pulling up just quickly before we conclude, maybe the timeline? Do you still have that PowerPoint that you can pop up for a second?
Oh, yeah, I have the PowerPoint.
On timeline, because I just wanted to draw you. I mean, we have about a year before we'd even be in the design phase. So there's quite a bit of back and forth going on. I want to say, sorry.
It takes a minute to warm up.
Do you remember? I wish I remembered right now what the timeline was, and I can't. But I believe we've
written it down. It helps. 18
to
the 2.
It's 2020.
Yeah, you know, but December 18 of when we're actually going out for.
Yes.
We'd be expecting permit completion. So between now and then, we'll be doing all of that work and probably bringing things back to you about what the building would look like.
So, yeah,
there.
Let's just take.
So pre-development would be all the way through December of 2018.
So we'd be making those decisions somewhere around.
You'll be looking at those decisions.
I don't know that you'll be, I think if you're not comfortable with something we're doing, but I don't know that we're asking you to mass or draw the building, but definitely give us feedback throughout. I mean, we don't want to develop something that you're not comfortable with, right?
It'd be well before December. Because it takes months to get the permits and stuff, so they're starting in December. The spring would be looking at final.
I just want one.
Yeah,
no, that's after 5 o'clock on a Friday.
It is after 5, Todd, on Friday.
Shit.
Come on, Todd.
Is there any concern about low hanging fruit being easy, and then we get towards the end of spending our resources, like, oh, we haven't done any supportive housing?
Yes.
I guess, is there a strategy for or an idea?
We've talked to the joint office a little bit preliminarily about in Home for Everyone. You know, the Mark, Jolyn, and the team about initial thoughts about what they're thinking with permanent supportive housing. They're not completely comfortable in telling us yet exactly what they'd be looking for to reach those, for instance, 300 units, but they've given us some preliminary ideas so we can factor that into our planning. We would be looking at least probably one standalone building of permanent supportive housing that we'll be trying to achieve early, really early on in our new development plans. It's going to be harder for us to do with an acquisition of an existing building, move a ton of permanent supportive housing in. We think that that could potentially even be an SRO unit, an SRO building that they'd be single room occupancy.
Oh, okay.
So where you have shared facilities for cooking.
Dorms and college.
Right, gotcha. Yes.
And they have asked for approximately 50 permanent supportive housing units, family size units, and then some scattered site units throughout. So we are talking with them and planning for those as we're looking at the new developments. We're also, we've also honestly started getting beginnings of PSH in the Ellington presently. So there are some families that we've moved out of the homeless family system. It was 16 a couple weeks ago. I don't know what it is now. Many of those were eligible for PSH services, and there is a mobile permanent supportive housing team. But Javier's right. Yeah, we our eye needs to be on the ball in every decision we make against the many layers of the dashboard we're going to need to be tracking. But yeah, we need to make sure toward the end of this that we need to become very more specific than what we have in the general RFI that you saw today.
I think for us, an oversight committee member, might be helpful for us to know what considerations are going into that. So for example, for this 30th and Powell site, if it's not a good fit for supportive housing, then why? I would like to be able to articulate why, and or vice versa, because I hate to be down the road and say, hey, oh, we haven't done this type of housing, and that site sure was perfect for it, but now it's too late. We've already built this on it. So just having a little bit of information about that helps.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Just a really quick reminder about the comments from the RFI and Carl left.
Yeah, he was changing it while you guys were talking about something else. He was making edits, so
I was watching. I think I have clarity on what needs to be revised. I think on one of the first pages, just the description of being specific around the distinction around preference for land acquisition and building acquisition, you know, kind of just calling that out more clearly. And then I think keeping the table, but we could probably just put like a primary preference and then a secondary preference around those two things, because that's also what's in the framework. It's like both of them are important, but when we're looking at land acquisition, we're really going to prioritize first on the high opportunity. But of course, the vulnerability will be a factor, but it'll be a secondary. So I think we can get those edits in and get it.
And there's a Carl and Antoinette are meeting early Monday morning. Are you in that meeting?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great.
So at this point, we anticipate being back on the last Monday of November 27th. And if anything comes up in between, I'm sure you will be contacted by Shannon.
And we're going to schedule the two I's for the standing committee.
Same approach, right?
So
yes.
Far, well, Stephen and someone else.
Yeah.
So I would ask, are there any concerns with 30th and Powell moving that forward with as a bond project, having not gone through this public process?
So we haven't heard a number, right? So the assumption is that, because we're talking about the building, and so are we assuming that it's $200,000 per unit times 200 units?
No, that's... We don't have a development budget
right.
yet. We're just talking about the massing.
We're talking about trying to move. Is this location, does it meet the
criteria
that we had in the site framework to begin to do
all of that
additional planning around
yeah.
funding, around about cost per unit, about what size we're looking at, about permits? I mean, meeting all of those other goals, we'll now undertake that if we all feel like this is a good location.
And the one that I would bring up is and I know that we're talking about high opportunity areas, but the optics around this first investment going into what's a very white neighborhood, and how do we, because the statement that we make around priority communities is access to. So, you know, again, affordable housing is most likely accessed by communities of color, but the neighborhood it's in, I think we need to just make sure we're aware of where this first one's going. There could be criticism from the community that, wait a minute, that's backwards from what we want to be accomplishing in our community.
Yeah, and I can understand that. The only what I would say also is that if you look at the Catholic Charities properties, Esperanza Court, that's right down the street from there, it's a heavy minority tenant population.
So that's why actually affirmative marketing. And
I understand. I'm just saying in terms of when we're talking about how we would lease up and our approach to the units themselves, it's from that as opposed to what the demographics on that area are right now.
Well, in the SAG, at the very last meeting, we debated a lot of this in a lot of detail. And, you know, there was a concept of also making sure that we were looking at, racial diversity as well. As we meet our targets, it's not just the neighborhood, but it's how we
tend to
the building.
But I think your point is simple. Like, it would be great for the next project that we get to celebrate to be in East Portland or a different Northeast Portland or something, because of the strong commitment to racial equity.
And I don't know that we'll be fully announcing that we're going to move this forward like Monday or anything like that. I mean, I would imagine we'll have a little bit more time. We'd like to reach back out to the neighborhood and do a few things. I mean, I think our timeline would be sometime around November 8th, and not because it's the year anniversary of the Bond Passage, but literally it just would happen to work out that way.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great weekend.